an ideologue of the woman's liberation movement, might be tempted to label the opening chapters of the Bible as male chauvinist. After all, Adam was created first, soul, and he was given a specific mission to dress, to tend the Garden of Eden. And Eve was only created that man might not have to live alone. And she was not given an independent commission. Rather, she was to be Adam's helpmate, Azer Conegdo. The very act of the creation of the woman, in a sense, symbolized this dependence. For a rib in the myth is taken from the body of Adam, and around that myth, woman is formed, as if she is derivative of Adam's very being, as if her whole raison d'etre depends upon her serving with and under Adam for his benefit. And I know of no claim which can bring the fire to a woman liberationist eye faster than the claim that a woman's being rests and justification rests upon the existence and the future and the plans of her man. She's a person in her own right. Now, only ignorance of history could allow anyone to claim that the Bible is male chauvinist in the sense of being part of a history-long conspiracy against women. In point of fact, the needs which are expressed by the women's rights movements do not emerge till very late in history, to urbanization and the Industrial Revolution and the existence of differentiated labor and of a leisure class, a largely feminine leisure class whose work is not immediately necessary to the survival of the family, until those elements of civilization occur. The psychological and emotional needs, which are the fuel of the women's rights movement, simply do not surface. In the Bronze Age culture, which nurtured the Bible, where survival was a desperate undertaking, where there was never sufficiency or security, where every member of the clan had to bend his shoulder and bear the burden of the whole clan, every man and every woman's work was precious and necessary, and every man and every new woman was satisfied that she was doing that for which she was created. In a society in which there is high infant mortality, rudimentary maternal care, where survival depends upon there being many hands to do the work, for there are few tools, if any tools, that can are labor-saving devices, where the clan must be a self-contained survival unit, and survival and security depend in large numbers upon numbers, in such a society, women must marry early and bear as many children as possible. Biology is, in fact, their destiny, and they rarely question it, if ever, because they recognize that they are contributing significantly to the survival of the whole. It would be as false to claim that the Bible reflects an attitude that is caustic about women's rights as it is to claim that the Bible espouses the women's rights movement. And yet I've heard that claim made. It's often the story that's told about the daughters of Zelophehad is often cited. It's told about the days of Moses, and it's recounted in the book of Numbers. While the children of Israel were wandering through the wilderness, they arranged the division according to the Bible of the about-to-be-conquered land. And each tribe received its appointed share, and each clan within the tribe was allotted that piece, that acreage, which was to be theirs. Now, according to the old Israelite custom, inheritance passed down through the male heirs. And there was among the tribe's people this man Zelophehad, one of the clan heads, who had no male heirs, though he had a number of very active daughters. And when he died without a male heir, these girls came together and they drew up a petition which they brought to Moses, requiring perhaps, that the share in the land which had been allotted to their father should pass on to them, that they shouldn't be without possession, without any possibility of survival in new land. And Moses, we're told, consulted God, and God agreed to honor this petition that these women should in fact inherit their father's allotted share. And he went further, and God established the original equal rights amendment, for he said, Ki umat ish, ein lo bein, v'avartem et nachalato levito. If a man dies and he has no son, then the inheritance shall pass directly to his daughters. Now, this is simply a case brought in some early period of the Israelite history which changed customary law, which had been patriarchal, where the son only inherited from the father and allowed inheritance to pass to the daughter. The case is cited and the oracular judgment is rendered. And it has really very little to do with women's rights in any sense in which we know it. One cannot ask of such a society as the society which nurtured the Bible to take a position for or against the women's rights movement. What we can ask of the Bible, if we're interested in its testimony, and we should be, what we can ask of the Bible is whether or not it looked upon women with respect, respect for their uniqueness, respect for their persons, or simply as sex objects, simply as workhorses, whether women are looked upon as somehow essentially inferior to men. And here we find that the Bible, for its time and place, is remarkably free of what's called today male prejudice. The woman of valor is blessed by her children and praised by her husband in the gate. In ancient Chinese society, which was a patriarchal society, just like ancient Israel's, the woman, according to the Confucian doctrine, owed to her male, the male members of her clan, three forms of absolute obedience. As a daughter, she must be absolutely obedient to her father. As a wife, she must be absolutely obedient to her husband. And as a widow, she must be absolutely obedient to her son. Compare this to the commandment, honor thy father and thy mother. The son is to respect his mother and to obey her as long as she lives. She is not without authority. She is a person who is to be respected. And the testimony of Hebrew law corresponds to the instruction of the Bible. In most Western Asian law codes, which we still possess, the adulterer is fined and the adulteress is stoned. In ancient Israel, there was a similar penalty for both. In most of the ancient law codes, when a woman's body was harmed by some kind of injury, she lost an arm or an eye or a leg, there was a minor fine. If a man was similarly injured, there was a higher fine. The Bible prescribes in the laws of personal injury, a woman's person is worth just as much as a man's. And there are obviously attempts in the Bible to create special protective legislation for the woman. A father could sell his daughter into slavery, but then a father could sell his son into slavery, or he could sell himself into slavery. There was very little free economy in those days, and if land was lost, a family had very little opportunity to survive unless they indentured themselves to someone else. But a father, unlike the common practice in Western Asia, could not sell his daughter into prostitution. And if her new master took this girl as his concubine, he could not simply pass her on if he was tired of her, resell her, nor could he be disencumbered of her on the sabbatical year, the seventh year of release. All other slaves were to be freed, but she remained under his protection. She had, by virtue of the relationship which they had established, she had certain kinds of claims for provision, for security, for protection from him. There's a concern for the woman. And we find in the Bible a number of women who are able to live independent lives, that is, lives independent of their role within the family or within marriage. There's Miriam, the daughter of the sister of Moses, who leads the great celebration of the tribes when they have successfully crossed the Red Sea. But more importantly, the Bible tells us that time and again she was able to stand up in the council of elders and make her voice heard and to argue there even against the authority of her brother Moses. And there was the judge, Deborah, who rallied the armies of the tribes against the marauding Amalekites and all her days judged them, that is, acted as the general leader of the community. And somewhat later, there was the prophetess Huldah, who brought the word of God to King Hezekiah in Jerusalem during a very tense moment in the last history of the southern kingdom, and was, in a sense, the moving light behind the great Deuteronomic Reformation, which gave us the fifth book of our Bible, which centralized cult and worship in Jerusalem. The testimony of the Bible is that the ancient Israelites had a great deal of respect for and concern for the presence, the person of the woman. More than this, they were not at all Puritan or Victorian in their attitudes towards the sexual relationships between a man and a woman. A woman was not simply to be a sex object. In fact, the Bible excoriates those women who have made themselves into sex objects, and the men who use them. The Bible is happy to, it rejoices in the way of a young man with a young maid. And more than this, the Bible insists that the woman has as much right to gratification in the sexual relationship as the man does. Ani le dodi, le dodi li, I am my beloved's, and my beloved's is mine. Now, one would have hoped that building on this rather hopeful foundation, normative Judaism, rabbinic Judaism, would have developed and extended the rights of women as society evolved and emerged from this rather primitive, first agricultural and then early urban society. But a strange thing happened in the development of history generally. Along about the 6th or 5th century before the Common Era, wherever there was civilization in Asia, Egypt, or in Europe, they developed a series of taboos in the relationships between men and women. Apartheid begins to be the order of the day. Women are pushed more and more apart from a kind of natural relationship with man into a woman's world. And all kinds of doors are closed against them or to them to prevent them from being part of the status world, the power world, the governing world. In ancient Persia, the princes, the wealthy, bring their women into the harem, into the seraglio, guarded by eunuchs, treat them obviously as purely sexual objects. One cannot think of a woman accompanying a Plato or an Aristotle walking through the groves of the academy, being part of any one of the Greek schools. This was a male society from which women were precluded. No woman ever spoke in the Forum or the Senate of Rome. It was a male society from which women were precluded. And later on in the Arab world, women are put behind the purda. They must wear the veil, even when they appear simply on the street on their way to market. There's obviously a kind of fear in this world that women will somehow entice men away from the serious business of life. There's an attempt to create taboo, to prevent too familiar rubbing of shoulders, as if this will somehow threaten the very survival of the family. Now, I've read no fully satisfactory explanation of why, at this particular stage of civilization, this sense of apartness, separate but equal, and then simply separateness develops between men and women. But there are a number of factors which one can cite. There are the growth of the city. In the farm, in the town, in the agricultural community, there were known families. The clan life was relatively stable. One knew all one's neighbors, and there was very little danger of an affair, of a sudden attachment, of a violation of what was very basic in those days, the rules of loyalty, but sexual loyalty between man and woman. But in the city, with the thronging and the crowding and the coming together, there was a danger, a reality of all kinds of misalliances. And obviously the society has tried to prevent these by bringing the woman into a condition where she was simply not seen in the street, in the public places, invisible to all except those to whom she belonged. There's obviously a concern to see in the woman enticement, allurement, flesh, as opposed to spirit, philosophy, wisdom. Women represent the worldly. The male begins to represent the mind, the power of the mind to work out rational thoughts, to reasonably control life, rather than the impulsive urge which drives one towards the sexual relationship. Celibacy becomes, among many faiths, the rule of the day. Whatever the reasons be, Judaism responds to this environmental pressure. And instead of Judaism evolving an ever more open relationship between men and women, during early rabbinic times and increasingly later on in the Muslim world, the world of men and the world of women is more and more separate. In the synagogue, women are behind a mechitza. They must sit on one side of a barrier, or in the Weiberschule, the balcony. Somehow, if one spends too much time talking with a woman, one not only, according to this tradition, wastes one time in idle gossip, because women's talk is obviously trivial, but one's thoughts are taken from the spiritual realm to the physical realm. One cannot concentrate on the religious undertaking. Therefore, women, in a sense, must be unseen in the sanctuary. Women are not to be trusted in terms of reporting. They are not to be admitted as witnesses. They're not to count for the minyan. More and more, the woman is pushed away. No woman was ever admitted to a rabbinic academy. In the first century before the common, of the common era, Jews established the first all-male system of universal education. But the woman was largely excluded. Oh, there was no prohibition against a woman becoming literate or mastering Torah. Simply no one really concerned himself or herself with it. And it was the rare woman during rabbinic times who had mastered reading and writing and Torah and Talmud, the very curricular stuff on which all men were weaned and educated. Now, watching this history, I could understand both how Judaism always, in a sense, conforms as it must to the environment of which it's a part, and I can understand also what seems otherwise trivial in the feminist movement today. And that's its concern with the gender of pronouns, with calling a person a chairperson rather than a chairman. After all, Judaism was bound to the revealed word of God. The rabbis, however the environment had impinged upon them, could not have done away with what the Bible specifically stated God willed. But every law in the Bible is stated in the male. It is the man, the second person, you, the male, the masculine. And so the rabbis were able to say, The positive commandments in the Bible for which there's a specific time are obligatory on the man. The woman may or may not observe them. There's no prohibition, but these are not obligatory to her. A man must put on the tefillin. A woman can. There's no law against it, but she need not. And building on this verbal base, on the base of language, the rabbis were able to erect a structure which more and more pushed the woman by customary practice away from what was the normal practice of the male in the synagogue or in liturgy. Women were pushed aside. Everything was open to them, but not obligatory on them. All kinds of explanations were developed. But that's the way that it went. And interestingly, one sees the phenomenon in rabbinic times, and one sees again in apartheid racial societies in modern times. One begins to hear that just as the Jews are particularly smart, or the blacks have soul, women have special characteristics. Women are more gentle. They're more sensitive. They're more tender-hearted. Are they even willing to say they have more faith? And what fascinates me when I read the more fanatic of the modern women's liberation movement is I sometimes hear these same justifications from the women liberals themselves. But they tell me, give us access to all the corridors of power, let us take over and we'll gentle down the world because women have a special talent for peace and for love and for harmony, as if the Furies weren't women. In any case, rabbinic Judaism, as it developed and codified its custom and its practice over the long centuries, honored the woman as long as she remained in the home, respected the woman as long as she remained busy with the things that the man did not want to be busy with. And this practice remained part and parcel of Jewish life until that time when each community made the break into the modern world. Now, the Jewish community was isolated in the Middle Ages from what happened in the larger world. And it moved into modern times, beginning in the last part of the 18th century, primarily in the 19th century, when a set of new ideas were coursing through the world. Newton had taught that all of the universe is one great unity. There is an energy which courses silently throughout the world, building and rebuilding, moving and refashioning itself. There's a natural order to all things. And Locke and Voltaire and Rousseau and Diderot had taught men to use reason, which is really little more in their usage than common sense, to see how man had built on the surface of this very natural, silent, moving, harmonious nature, a series of artificial constructs which separated lord from vassal, Frenchman from German, Christian from Jew, man from woman. And it was this philosophy of the Enlightenment, given force, political force, by the great revolutions of the 18th and 19th century, which began to allow people to conceive. Now that there was more abundance, more industry, more differentiation of labor, of a kind of society in which woman might be treated in her own right without specific reference to her, the basic biological responsibilities, the home responsibilities, which have been traditionally vested in her. The first women liberals were all men. They had to be. Men controlled the society. Men evolved the philosophy. Men created the machines. Men created the abundance which made it possible for there to be women of leisure in the middle class. Let me trace the women's liberation movement within our own tradition. Emancipation came to the Jews of Europe from west to east, beginning with the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century. Within 15 years after the beginning of emancipation, when the ideas of enlightenment had quickly been absorbed by the more liberal, urbanized, westernized elements of the Jewish community, we find a liberal religious movement developing. and what's its very first religious act? To take away the mechitza, to take away the barrier which separates the men and the women in the synagogue. And what's its first institutional reform? To create a religious school which is not a cheder. A cheder was an all-male school. A religious school was for men and for women, for boys and for girls. And the very first bit of liturgical innovation among Reformed Jews was the confirmation. A form of graduation, a rite of passage, and of initiation, which was to replace the bar mitzvah, the all-male act of initiation, by an act in which men and women at the beginning of adulthood, at the threshold of adulthood, could enter into their adult responsibilities. From the very beginning, the most dramatic changes in the liturgy in practice were those which had to do with the manumission of women, and they were all enacted during the first century or so of reform by men. Rites open up. There is new opportunity for the woman, but then we notice an interesting thing, and I cite you again simply the evidence from within our own tradition. Shortly after the Central Conference of American Rabbis was organized here in the United States, in 1892, the rabbis in their wisdom assembled, all men, passed a resolution that ordination and admission to the Central Conference should be open to men and to women equally. And it took 80 years for the first woman to come to the seminary, to enroll in the seminary, and to be ordained by it. For 80 years, the right has been there, and for 75 of those years, no one came forward to exercise that right. And one can duplicate and replicate this experience throughout, in all areas of life, during the last century or century and a half. There have been more women's rights than there have been women who have been willing to make the effort to exercise these rights, which has led the women's movement, the feminist movement, to conceive of itself now as a two-tiered affair. On the one hand, there is the need for women's legal reform, for women's rights, for the right to vote, for the right to own property, for the right to open access to all levels of power, for the right to occupy any particular employment slot, for the right to make the basic decisions about one's own body, the medical decisions involving birth control and abortion and the like. These are all in the general area of women's rights. But the new feminists say, more than women's rights, we need women's liberation. And by that they describe a rather hazy group of psychological and emotional elements in our society which they say impinge on their exercising the rights which have already been won or any other right which will be given them. It's hard, they say, in a male society which assumes that there's some relationship between physical strength and the ability to do one's work to move into certain areas. It's hard to convince an employer that pregnancy and child responsibility will not stand in the way of a daily appearance on the job. It's hard to move into male bastions with male humor and a male psychology where one is treated always as an alien or at very most as an allurement who can be dispensed with a little bit of charm. In a male society, the woman is always nominated as a secretary of the board, never really allowed to exercise real power in the community. Women's rights are fine, they say, but there must be a total reconstruction of the minds, the heart, the spirit, the sociology, the psychology, everything in our society if women are truly to be liberated. And the more determined among these feminists level the burden of their attack upon marriage and upon the family, because it is in this area that biology tends to trip them up. They attack marriage and the family because somehow the child, the husband, stands in their way of their true liberation. Several things I think need to be said. The first is that in the last 100, 150 years, we have moved a great deal of the way towards providing for women equal pay, equal rights, and all those reforms, those legal reforms which can be done, I believe, should be legislated and should be achieved. But it's one thing to legislate reform, and it's another thing to take advantage of the opportunity which is there. It's one thing to say, I insist on women's rights to occupy all levels of power. It's another thing to pay one's dues at the ward level, by running for a whole series of office, by being constant in one's political concerns, by being involved day in and day out, and not simply when there's a crusade, which has a degree of publicity which one can find a degree of excitement in. Women's Lib, the second level, often says we want the same rights that a man has. And men respond, you're welcome to them. Because I think in the women's liberation side of things, there's an overvaluation of the freedom that they think men have. Men are free every morning to go to work. And men are free every day to say, yes, I agree to their employer. And men are free every day to entertain their customers, some of whom are bores and most of whom are boors. And men are free to assume major financial responsibility for family and children. And if a man should decide that he wants to spend the next 6 months meditating in a Zen Buddhist ashram, and he picks himself up and he goes to the beautiful Big Sur coast of California, the woman can get the police and they'll bring him back from Big Sur for non-support and he'll be thrown into jail. Now, men, by and large, have not objected to these responsibilities because they have recognized that what they do is essential for the well-being of those whom they love, that there's a network of responsibility in family and in community of which they're a major part. Much of the literature of women's liberation assumes a kind of radical freedom, the freedom of childhood, which is really irresponsibility. I want to do my own thing in my own way at my own time and only when I want to do it. And if you don't like the way I play, here's your divorce, here are your children, I'll go my way. What we need in a very major sense in our society is not only greater freedom, but a much keener awareness of community, of the ties of love, of family, of responsibility. And I hear very little about these ties and these responsibilities in the women's liberation literature. I hear a petulance, and I hear a kind of juvenile demand that the game of life be played by my rules in my way, or else. And the men quiver when they hear this because they know that hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Now, society will change. And many of the very real impediments which stand in the way, which do impede a woman from moving as a man moves now into the larger society, will be changed. But women cannot ask for a kind of freedom that no other segment of the society except our adolescents enjoy. They can't ask that the male absorb all of the responsibilities Obviously, responsibilities need to be shared. And obviously, those who want a kind of radical freedom, freedom from their biology, will either have to develop religions, cultures which justify celibacy, or determine that they will live with complete birth control, or else develop for themselves, first on a private basis, and if they're large enough, on a quasi-public basis, these systems of child care, which will allow them to be free day in and day out to pursue, as a man must now pursue his occupation. It's entirely feasible that this will happen. But if you want children, then you must be willing to invest time, and more importantly, love and protection with the child. And that's said equally to the man or to the woman. But the woman has a certain obligation, partnership, obviously, in this. And if you want the security of a stable relationship with a man, we call it marriage in old-fashioned terms, if you want that kind of relationship, then there must be at least, at the very least, a give and take. There must be a home. There must be roots. And if there are dirty dishes to be done, the man needs perhaps to do his share of them, but you have your share too. Women must be willing to do their share. And I think women must recognize that so much of the frustration which has surfaced in women's liberation has very little to do with restriction and has a great deal to do with their own lack of drive and lack of initiative. The Temple Women's Association, about 10 days ago, had a major forum on women's liberation. That's what suggested that I talk about it today. I sat quietly then, and I decided I'd get my licks in later. And at that program, one of the panelists, a woman of great accomplishment, who runs one of the major health clinics associated with our university, who has earned every important academic degree, who has had a happy marriage and raising a child, got up and said to the group, "You know, I've really never understood what all the shrying is all about." And I was fascinated by this admission, because here was a woman who had an interest in mental health, who had set out and gotten her degrees, she'd been admitted to the university, she'd gone her own way, she'd gained respect in the so-called man's world, she was running one of the major institutions of the town, she'd made somehow her own accommodations within her marriage and within her family, and she couldn't understand the frustration that was seething, the violence, the escalated language of violence which was coming out of so many mouths. Now, not everybody is as capable or as determined, obviously, or as clear when they're young as to which way they want to go. But certainly you'll admit this much with me, I think, that a society cannot be asked to provide a structure which allows you to be filled with self-pity simply because you haven't enough initiative to take advantage of what already is there. And if women are truly to find their independence, there's one easy way. Take it. Take advantage of what's there. There are many more rights than most women have yet decided to enjoy. And as you take your freedom within community, within family, you'll make the private agreements with a man, with the children, which are necessary to be made. They'll work out. And you'll find slowly growing the kinds of social structures which are necessary to complement your need. The institutions will respond. What I'm saying is, it's not simply a matter of gaining through legislation or demonstration more rights. What's needed now is a determination by the woman of what role she really wants to play in the social order. And no woman has the right to say to other women, mine is the only way. The only way which justifies your existence as a woman is to be a liberated woman. That's not true. If you want to live in the kind of family structure which is of the last generation, if you find the role of mother, of volunteer, of wife to be totally fulfilling, why should women's liberation force such a woman to take a role that is not instinctively right for her? And on the other hand, why should such a woman preclude the independent woman from working out as best she can her own destiny? And after all that any of us can do, men or women, is to work out as best we can our destiny. There are restrictions, there are limitations on all of us, some imposed by the society, some imposed by our sex, some imposed by our bundle of talents and our lack of talent, some imposed by our own interests, and some imposed by our own indulgences. None of us is a free and unfettered creature. And I think that we will really begin to work out a kind of meaningful relationship between men and women at all levels of society only when we begin to accept that basic fact. Women's rights are totally feasible. Women's liberation is impossible. Men's rights are totally feasible. The man's total liberation is totally impossible. Amen.